Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker for today's program on Parkinson's disease nutritional therapy. Steve Blake, science doctorate, is faculty nutritional biochemist at Hawaii Pacific Neuroscience. He is a research scientist who has just finished a clinical study successfully using nutrients to combat neurodegeneration. He is author of Parkinson's Disease, Dietary Regulation of Dopamine, the McGraw-Hill College textbook Vitamins and Minerals Demystified, A Nutritional Approach to Alzheimer's Disease, and co-author of Mosby's Drug Guide for Nurses, 4th edition. He authored the Diet Doctor software to analyze dietary nutrients. Steve has a doctorate in holistic health, specializing in nutritional biochemistry. He also has a doctorate in naturopathic medicine and is a neuromuscular therapist. He and his wife, Catherine, live on an organic farm on Maui that's powered by the sun. Steve?
Thank you very much for the warm welcome, and thank you, Dr. Bill Grant. Well, it's nice to be here today. I have some research that I've been doing. I work in a neuroscience center with neurologic disorders, and my wife and I have been counseling people with Parkinson's disease for many years, and we have found, looking in the biomedical research in peer-reviewed medical journals, some very interesting things that our neurologists really don't seem to notice or pick up on or use because they're busy juggling the drugs. And the drugs can be very, very important to be juggled just perfectly with Parkinson's disease. So I get the really fun position of digging through the research and finding things that can really help, but that are completely non-profitable. One of the dietary approaches that I'll talk about today can cut your motor symptoms in half. If there was a drug that could do that, heaven knows how many billions of dollars that would be worth. But the nice part for you is that you can do it yourself, and you don't really need a doctor. And as Bill pointed out, I'm not a medical doctor. I'm a research scientist. So let's get into how to do it. There's going to be three parts to my talk today. The first part is that food, especially excess protein, can interfere with the production of dopamine. And I'm going to talk and tell you how to adjust your diet so that tyrosine is made into dopamine. Now, those of you who are taking levodopa also needs to be transported into the bloodstream and then into the brain and get to the cells, the dopamine-producing cells. And the same thing applies to those. We need to get that drug to the brain. It not only doesn't do much good floating around in the body before it gets to the brain, but some of the symptoms, such as nausea, the side effects, can be because it's in the body and not getting to the brain where we want it to go. The second part of my talk results from a natural curiosity of mine. How did Parkinson's come about? Why did people get Parkinson's? What is it that happened that killed off those dopamine-producing cells to result in the symptoms and problems in Parkinson's disease? So I'm going to take a look at that, and I'm going to show you some foods. Warning, some of these foods may be tasty, normal foods that you're used to. They may harbor environmental contaminants, these particular foods, that can kill off dopamine-producing cells and also inactivate some of the enzymes that are crucial to making dopamine. The third part of this talk is about neuroprotection. And as Bill mentioned, I did just complete successfully a study on Alzheimer's disease and nutrition. I took people who were just between mild cognitive disorder and Alzheimer's disease at the beginning of the study, and at the end of the study, we were really aiming at stopping progression or slowing progression, but what happened was they turned out to be almost normal in cognition. In other words, they improved, which is a good thing. So neuroprotection means a lot. Because when your neurologist initially told you about Parkinson's disease, he or she probably said, this is a neurodegenerative disease. It will get worse and worse. luckily, with Parkinson's disease, it gets worse slowly, and people can live a long, productive life with Parkinson's disease. So it's one of the advantages of Parkinson's disease as versus other neurologic disorders. But I want to talk about how you can, through food and nutrients, slow the degeneration of your brain, perhaps stop it. A little anatomy here. Parkinson's disease occurs in the substantia nigra, the pars compacta part, that red part, in the midbrain. You can see it's right in the middle of the brain. And there are extrusions from those neurons that go to the striatum that actually affect our movement. So this is the target of all of the drugs, and it's also the target of the nutrients that I'm going to talk about today. Without enough dopamine, you may develop gait irregularities. Slowness is the most common, technically called bradykinesia. I'm not sure who Brady was, but he must have been very slow. As time progresses, this slowness can be really quite annoying and make it difficult even to move from a wheelchair to a chair. Tremors, rigidity can affect different parts of the body, and there's often a mask on the face, and I think in the next slide, the next one after this, I'll show you some more about the symptoms of it. In looking at the biomedical literature, what I'm looking for is I'm looking at what usually the studies are on reducing risk of Parkinson's disease. Reducing risk, what does that mean? That means reducing risk of death of dopaminergic neurons. And by the time Parkinson's disease is first diagnosed, typically 50 to 70% of the dopamine-producing cells are already dead. So that means that those of us in this room without Parkinson's disease are undoubtedly down some percentage of our dopamine-producing cells as well. So whether you have or don't have Parkinson's disease, these techniques can be helpful, especially the neuroprotection and avoiding the foods that are killing off these cells. As far as progression goes, it's the same thing. Progression means more of the dopamine-producing cells are dying, more of them are becoming inactivated because their enzymes aren't functioning anymore. So risk reduction and stopping of progression really mean the same thing in most of what I'll talk about today. Here's a picture. Oftentimes, people with Parkinson's disease have a bit of a stooped posture forward. And this is because of a balance sense. One of the techniques our neurologists use is to lean people back against a wall, and if they feel like they're going to fall over vertically, then that's one of the clinical signs of Parkinson's disease. The mask face, tremors can occur anywhere from the lips to the fingers to the knees to the arms. It just varies in people where that is, but the medication usually controls those tremors for a period of time. As I mentioned, Parkinson's disease can be neurodegenerative and progressive, and so there are scales. The Hoehn and Yahr scale is one of the older scales that measures mostly motor movements. And one is considered almost normal and four wheelchair bound. So your doctor may talk to you about where you are on that Hoehn and Yahr scale. A more complete scale is called the Unified Parkinson's Disease Assessment Scale, and that one looks at not only movement disorders, but also thinking ability, which can be affected sometimes in Parkinson's disease. Approximately one-third of people who live long with Parkinson's disease may develop Lewy body dementia. Other people can also develop Lewy body dementia, and not all people with Parkinson's disease do, but Lewy body dementia is problems thinking and remembering things. Also something that I'll address during this talk. In fact, here it is popping right up. Lewy bodies are clumps of protein inside nerve cells. Alpha-synuclein is the most common protein that gets clumped in here. Here we find a great similarity with the tau tangles in Alzheimer's disease, where abnormal proteins also are inside cells. As I mentioned, not everyone with Parkinson's disease gets Lewy body dementias, but it is important to keep track of your mental functioning and do all of the things that improve mental functioning, which would include exercise, which is also very good for Parkinson's disease. One of the studies that I like, there's several on this, is ballroom dancing for Parkinson's disease. It seems to be really helpful. Of course, first of all, you have someone to hold on to so you can't fall down. That's nice. And you're hugging someone during the dance. And the movement seems to really help with movement after the dance. Many other forms of exercise and physical therapy can be very, very helpful for Parkinson's disease. I would suggest that you check those. They're not really part of my talk today, though. This machine here, speaking of exercise, is a very elaborate exercise system so that it looks really impossible for this person to fall down while he's getting his daily workout. But exercise can really help. Assisted exercise is what's usually used in the journals and has the best results, where you have a trainer who's helping you through the exercise, helping you to walk and get your walking a little bit better, for instance. I'm not going to cover all of the drugs. I just really have one slide on drugs. Levodopa can be transformed in the dopamine-producing cells through an enzyme into dopamine. And dopamine is what you want more of in Parkinson's disease, and maybe have less of it than you need to begin with. So levodopa, sometimes carbidopa is given with levodopa. There are many other drugs given, and your neurologist will guide you to the correct amount and timing of the drugs. Now, in early stage Parkinson's, you might take the drugs at 6 a.m., at noon, and at 6 p.m., so 6 hours in between. Later on, perhaps after a year on this regimen, it can vary, you may find that at 11 o'clock in the morning, your symptoms are start to recur. You may have some trembling or some gait disturbances. So that's called an off time. Your on time is when your medication's working. So you get an off time, or also called a fluctuation. These fluctuations are annoying and difficult. And then when you take your pill at noon, it may take half an hour for the effect to, you know, settle down the tremors and the slowness. What we'd like to do is reduce this off time, and some of what I'll talk about today will help reducing the off time and the fluctuations. You may possibly, with dietary methods, be able to take less levodopa with the guidance of your neurologist, or perhaps less frequently. We have actually, in early cases of Parkinson's disease, avoided medication entirely for the time being, at least. One man, John, came to us, and he had early stage Parkinson's, and the neurologist recommended immediately levodopa carbidopa, but he didn't want to take the pills. So she sent him over to us, which she does all the time, and we worked with him. John's a wonderful man. His wife's very supportive, and he instituted the program that I'm going to talk to you about today. And he made really good progress. He had a masked face quite a bit. He had a stooped posture. His hands were trembling so badly that he was embarrassed to be in public and had trouble writing and other delicate tasks. Over the course of just a month, with a change in diet, his tremors went away except when he was stressed out. And over the course of a year, his tremors now are completely gone. And the last time I saw John, he had some dimples, which is a really good sign that the masked face is actually going away. His posture is straightening up. So here we're seeing a possibility that in very early stages, we can see a little bit of reversal or stopping of the disease. And that's my goal. I don't want to give anyone false hopes, and yet I am a hopeful person, and I have seen people get better instead of worse. And that's my goal for all of you here today. A little bit of science, hopefully not too much. How is dopamine made? Well, tyrosine is a common component of food. You don't need to take extra tyrosine. It's in the food anyway. It's an amino acid, a component of protein. Just like all the other amino acids, of which there's 8 for adults that are essential. Now, all but one of these 8 essential amino acids use the same transport mechanism as tyrosine to get from the stomach into the bloodstream, the large neutral amino acid transporter, and more importantly, from the bloodstream into the brain. It is crucial that the tyrosine get to the brain so then it can be made by tyrosine hydroxylase, this enzyme, into levodopa. You may also be taking levodopa as a drug. That drug also needs the large neutral amino acid transporter to get from the blood into the blood and then from the blood into the brain. If there's too much protein, in the diet. There are too many amino acids being put into the bloodstream. Then you can think of it as, in San Francisco, you understand this very well, a clogged up on-ramp to the freeway of the blood system. There's too many cars. So the tyrosine cars, the levodopa cars, have a hard time getting onto the freeway. When you get to your exit to the brain, the tyrosine cars and the levodopa cars are crowded out by all the other amino acids and can't get to the brain. There's a lot of good science showing that this is how it works. So one of the solutions would be to lower protein to the amount you require, but not the huge excesses that Americans are prone to. Well, I'll just talk a little bit more. The levodopa is then made into dopamine with another important enzyme, and then the dopamine is degraded by monoamine oxidase. Some drugs prevent this degradation, so dopamine stays around longer. Unfortunately, dopamine, if it's not sequestered in the vesicles, can actually damage and kill the brain cell. So it's delicate work to do anything but let your body's own machinery make the dopamine and sequester it, and then that's sent down to the striatum to help us with our movements. I have a book that summarizes this talk today, this one, and my wife has a cookbook that is very popular because in order to implement the program, we're not talking about pills. This is food. So ways to prepare the food, to make it tasty, to make it easy, this is what she's got in her cookbook. As I was mentioning, this excess dietary protein blocks levodopa transport into the brain. I think I covered this slide already. The transport into the brain is really stopped by too much protein. And Americans get too much protein. One of my projects is the Diet Doctor software, which I've been upgrading now for many years. And this, you put in what you ate in a day, and it reads out all your nutrient levels, including protein. Typically, when I look at the protein of a normal American diet, it's about 150 grams a day. And everyone in this room needs 46. So there's about 100 extra grams of protein there that interfere with this process of getting the tyrosine and the levodopa into the bloodstream and then the brain. So that's one approach. You will see citations at the bottom of the slides. This is a 2014 study in the Journal of Parkinsonism and Restless Leg Syndrome. Parkinsonism is any problem that can cause the symptoms of Parkinson's disease, but Parkinson's disease is the only one that responds to levodopa and is specifically a dopamine problem. Now, this study was done by Luciana Baroni, an Italian researcher. She's very good. We're both in the International Vegetarian Union. And when I mentioned this study to our chief neurologist for Parkinson's disease, she said she must have been testing wrong. She must have been not looking at off times and on times, because you can't get a 50% reduction in motor problems with diet. So I contacted Luciana Baroni, and we emailed back and forth quite a bit. And yes, she was only testing in the on state, and yes, with the scales used, both the Honan-Yahr scale went from about 2 to over 3, and the Unified Parkinson's Disease Rating Scale went from 25 to 46, just about double the ability to move freely and the lack of tremors in people who followed this low diet. Now, the diet she used was interesting because her population was already eating a plant-based breakfast and lunch, and their total protein was 67, not 150 like most Americans. And she reduced that by changing dinner in part of the participants to a plant-based dinner, and the other participants ate their regular dinner. So she went down to 50, about the needed amount of protein, from only 67, and she got these results. So no wonder that people with even higher protein to start off with get even better results when they lower that protein down. Isn't this exciting? There's a couple other studies I want to mention. This one on the top, practical applications of a low-protein diet. After only 1 week, the plant-based diet, both tyrosine and levodopa were more effectively absorbed and transported to increase dopamine. One of the things that we find, if I counsel someone who might have a stroke or might have a heart attack on dietary changes, they might or might not make them. And they might or might not feel much different if they do or don't take them until, of course, they get a heart attack or a stroke. But with Parkinson's disease, it's really quite different because you can feel the changes very quickly after a day or a week. One man came in, and because people tend to be thin when they're older with Parkinson's disease, he was eating bacon and eggs for breakfast. His wife was feeding him a hearty breakfast. Well, he's eating also very heavy lunch and dinner. After our counseling session, he went home, and his wife just changed breakfast, only breakfast, and he ate oatmeal with fruit for breakfast instead of bacon and eggs. The change, the next time, 1 month later, we came back, we asked his wife, how's he doing? And she said, about a 25% improvement, both in physical symptoms and in thinking ability. I said, when did you notice this improvement? She said, the next morning, after the change in breakfast. So the changes are quick, and they're pretty noticeable. So that's something nice. And, of course, the changes the other way are noticeable, too. If a person goes back to a very high-protein meal, they find all of a sudden their levodopa drug is not as effective in the body. The second study prolonged the effectiveness of levodopa therapy because they used an adequate but low-protein diet. This was from the Archives of Neurology. This is a Brazilian study that was done, and of course in Brazil they eat a lot of red meat. What they did is they took a group and they lowered just the red meat, not all of the, you know, not chicken or fish or even pork, but just, you know, the red meat. And they found they got motor skills improved 60% in 6 months, 50% just in the first 3 months. And this is kind of a partial program because they're only doing a little bit. They didn't have a control group, and they also used riboflavin, vitamin B2, which is safe and has no upper limit. So I thought it was interesting to mention that. One of the reasons that a plant-based diet is so effective with Parkinson's disease is that the fiber. Many Americans get 10 to 20 grams of fiber a day, perhaps even less. And really, 40 to 50 grams would be ideal for humans, for good digestion, and also for fiber. Now, the fiber slows digestion of the levodopa and the tyrosine-containing foods so that you get a little bit out, and that freeway on-ramp then can go a little bit on, and then later a little bit more on, can go to the brain little by little, making the levodopa therapy more effective. And in some cases, levodopa has been able to be reduced either in frequency or in quantity by neurologists who are seeing that people no longer need quite as much or as often. And that's really to be preferred because over the course of time, people find that their medication needs to be taken closer and closer together. That 6 a.m. to noon may become 6 a.m., 9 a.m. and noon. And with one wonderful old guy we worked with who's had Parkinson's disease for 35 years, still walks with a stick stubbornly, falls. He used to fall down every day. He actually went on this program, and he quit falling down and started working in his garage on carpentry, which he hadn't done in 10 years. But he was taking medication every hour and switching medication. So it can get really frequent and annoying later on. We would like to stop that, you know. We'd like to keep you on the medication you're on today and not have it get worse so you need more. A perfect diet for Parkinson's disease, now, many people need extra calories, and my wife's cookbook has a lot of high-calorie things. One of the really fun parts about having Parkinson's disease is that you can eat things like macadamia nuts from Hawaii. We come from Maui. Those little cans of macadamia nuts that are salted and roasted and are so totally delicious. What turns out, they're 86% fat, so there's very little protein in them, and they're totally delicious. But one can is 900 calories. So for those of us who don't want to gain weight, we really have to eat just a small handful of mac nuts. But for you folks who are trying to gain weight, you can eat a can a day and really get some serious calories going in there without raising your protein. And another really nice recipe for keeping protein down, my wife has found that you can take avocados and stir in chocolate and sugar and vanilla, stir them up really good, freeze them, and you have chocolate avocado ice cream. This has been a favorite of many of the people we work with. And calories, oh, plenty of calories. Protein, still low. and excellent fats in both cases. The other thing about a plant-based diet is that there are neuroprotective elements, and I'll be talking about that as we go along. Will patients change their diet? Well, it doesn't take much effort to change your diet for a day or a week, and you could do a diet experiment to see if it'll work. Actually, Joe's wife gave this quote, "We plan to continue the diet, and it has been helpful to discover that it's not as hard to do as we anticipated. There's nothing like good results to keep us motivated." So it's doable, certainly, to try this diet out. I understand that a lot of favorite foods have a lot of protein in them. But remember, you're getting adequate protein on this diet. In fact, it's almost impossible to get less than adequate protein on any diet that I've ever measured. There have been three people with low protein in 35 years of checking diets, and they were all women under 80 pounds who simply weren't getting enough calories to really support themselves. Okay, so we've covered the dietary protein part of it. What do you think? Anybody willing to try an adequate protein diet instead of a high protein diet? I think it might be a good thing to try. By the way, if you do happen to lower your protein, it's a package deal. The animal foods that have a lot of protein also have a lot of saturated fat, which can make your risk of heart disease, certainly heart attacks and strokes, much higher. So the side effects of my therapy are very, very good. They're going to lower your risk of quite a few different diseases. So now we're going to move into what is it that caused those dopamine-producing cells in the middle of your brain to die off in the first place? I wanted to track this down. I think it's fascinating that very few neurologists track this down. I mean, they all seem to know that nicotine is protective, but we certainly don't want people to start smoking. It might be too late once you have Parkinson's disease anyway. One thing that's been found in the scientific literature and is fairly well agreed upon is that, in general, pesticides increase risk and progression of Parkinson's disease. These days, organic food is almost the same price as non-organic foods, quite available everywhere from Costco to your local grocer. And I think it might make more sense for people with Parkinson's disease to eat organic than other people. Although I try and eat as much organic food as I can myself because of my studies. This large meta study looked at 46 studies on pesticides and Parkinson's disease risk, and exposure was about 62%. Resulted in a 62% greater risk of Parkinson's disease among job-related exposure, 2.5 times the risk, and with certain pesticides, 5 times the risk. There's one particular pesticide, rotenone, that is particularly deadly for Parkinson's disease. It seems to kill off the cells in just the wrong way. Home use of pesticides can also raise the risk of Parkinson's disease, so you might want to consider, you know, boric acid for cockroaches and cinnamon for ants and all the other non-damaging ways of doing that. Most of the studies are looking at organochlorine pesticides, but I wondered about organophosphate pesticides because they work on the nervous system by basically increasing acetylcholine transmission until muscles lock up. And certainly locked up muscles is part of Parkinson's disease. So I did find this study in Occupational Environmental Medicine just a couple years ago that pesticide use of the organophosphate insecticides, malathion's one example of that, raised the risk 4 times. That's pretty high risk. Pesticides tend to concentrate in animal fat, and this is called biomagnification. This is very well known in science. One book, Aquatic Pollution, he traced biomagnification up to 100,000 times the amount in the seawater in the muscles and fat cells of the predatory birds who are eating the predatory fish, who are eating the other predatory fish, who are eating the pollutants. So biomagnification can really occur, for instance, in a cow during its lifetime. These persistent organic pollutants are now everywhere. The organochlorines do not break down in the environment, so the cow will build up in its body a residue of organochlorine pesticides. And then the people who eat the cow will get that residue in them and build up in the human body, another biomagnification. There are certain ones. In this one, this study is a postmortem study. They looked at the brains of people with Parkinson's disease, obviously after they'd passed away. They found higher levels of organochlorine pesticides in general, but especially dieldrin, concentrated in the fatty tissue, concentrated right in the dopamine-producing parts of the brain. So we're going to look at where dieldrin is found, and you may decide you don't want to eat any more dieldrin. Might be a good idea. More animal fat in general, because of this bioaccumulation of persistent organic pollutants, raised the odds of Parkinson's disease over 5 times. Annals of Neurology is a very good journal that reported this study. The actual odds ratio was 5.3, so over 5 times. So there's 2 things about animal foods that are a problem. One is the animal fat concentrates the specific pollutants that go to the dopamine-producing cells and kill them and or inactivate the enzymes we need to make dopamine. And the second one is that they have a lot of protein. They looked at pesticides, and lindane is one that raised the odds of getting Parkinson's disease 4.39 times over normal risk. And you see that even with Alzheimer's disease, lindane levels were low. With a control, lindane levels were low. But with Parkinson's disease, lindane levels were very high. This is a very high correlation. This type of study can show only an association, not a causality, but the totality of studies we're looking at indicate a causality of these particular persistent organic pollutants, especially lindane. Milk, eggs, dairy products, and to a lesser extent, fish can bioaccumulate lindane. Dairy products are pretty well known to be a problem with Parkinson's disease. A large study showed that there's a decreased risk of Parkinson's disease with decreased dairy product consumption. 60% less likely to get Parkinson's disease. Now, there's several reasons. One, of course, dairy products are very high in protein, and if they're low in fat, they're higher in protein. Dieldrin and lindane, two of the very common organochlorine pesticides that kill off our dopamine-producing ability, were found concentrated in dairy products. Also, uric acid is something in our blood that's an antioxidant, and dairy products are well known to inactivate this antioxidant. Antioxidants are very important to keep our brains healthy and to stop neurodegeneration. There are certainly many others besides uric acid. And finally, endotoxins are formed. When milk is first gotten from the cow, it has bacteria that forms very rapidly. And this must be sterilized. We all heard about raw milk and the problems if it's not sterilized. Well, the bacteria are killed, but the bacterial remains, their little skeletons, are still in the milk, and these endotoxins, or lipopolysaccharides, are then absorbed into the bloodstream, creating more inflammation. And this inflammation can aggravate problems such as Parkinson's disease. So there's several mechanisms. This little bar graph we have here shows the dark line shows no effect whatsoever. To the left would be if there were any studies showing that milk was protective for Parkinson's disease. But you see, there's no studies there at all. They're all showing various levels of higher risk and higher progression of Parkinson's disease, every single study on dairy products and Parkinson's disease. And this kind of consensus in science leads me to believe that it might be wise for you to consider not eating dairy products. Can that be done? Actually, it's really quite easy now. We have people try Smart Butter, Earth Balance instead of butter, and they all seem to like it and spread it on their toast and works fine. As far as ice cream goes, the almond and the soy-based ice creams are delicious and come in any flavor you can think of, and they're very high in calories, too, people who want to gain weight. As far as cheese goes, there isn't really a great substitute for cheese. Nut butters are one thing for creamy, rich, fatty satisfaction, but without the lindane and dieldrin. And there are many other substitutes, such as almond milk. The Silk brand seems to be a favorite for myself and many other people, both soy and almond milk. Silk, you can get chocolate, vanilla, regular, and they're delicious and creamy, kind of like the milk we had when we were kids before we had to drink skim milk, which tastes like water almost. So in a way, it's an up level to go that direction. A study in Honolulu, where one of our clinics is based, 2.3 times less Parkinson's disease risk in non-dairy product users versus people who use dairy products. Now, I'm done talking about dairy products for the time being. I know that cheese is a much beloved part of, you know, pizza and burritos and cheese and apples and all that, and it might be a stretch for you to move away from it. But I think that you might want to consider it if your goal is to not have any more of your dopamine-producing cells die. I think that would be my goal. And certainly, I haven't had any cheese in decades and decades. I've actually been vegetarian 46 years, 66 years of age now. So I wouldn't dream of eating cheese with what I know about it. Now let's get to another favorite food. Polychlorinated biphenyls. Levels have been found to be higher in Parkinson's disease brains compared with normal brains. They accumulate in fat, very much like the organochlorine pesticide, so they bioaccumulate. They're persistent everywhere. I mean, from the North Pole to the South Pole, they're everywhere in the environment. They're made to insulate electrical transformers and for industrial uses, and they got out. They were actually stopped making them in 1977, and they're still everywhere. They just switched to polybromylated biphenyl esters, which are possibly even worse, in 1977, so it's not like they stopped really making them. They disrupt our neurotransmitter symptoms, they damage cognitive function, and they increase stress. But more to the point, in Parkinson's disease, they've been found to inhibit tyrosine hydroxylase and aromatic acid decarboxylase. These two enzymes, you may remember from an earlier screen, the tyrosine hydroxylase takes tyrosine. Now, people with Parkinson's disease are still making dopamine with tyrosine. They just need additional dopamine from levodopa. The tyrosine cannot be made into levodopa in the brain anymore because of these PCBs found in fish. And this is a big problem. Also, once you have levodopa, either as a drug or made from tyrosine, the enzyme responsible for making dopamine is inactivated. Here's something good, some really good news. These brain cells aren't dead. They're just not working. These enzymes are made constantly, and they're damaged constantly by the polychlorinated biphenyls in your diet. So if you stop eating them, these PCBs definitely flow out of the body. They're measured in urine. And people have found that when you stop eating fish, the urine levels go down and down because your body wants to get rid of them. So it may be possible for some of those dopamine-producing cells that right now the enzymes are inactivated. They can't make dopamine. But there's hope for those cells. There's hope that those cells can reinvigorate themselves, that the genes can, you know, tell the RNA to make some more of these enzymes, and now they'll work because you don't have the PCBs. So in a way, this is a very positive thing, that there's a chance that you could make more dopamine yourself, and this is where you may be able to tell your neurologist, I'm having no off times, I'm having no tremors, can we back off either in frequency or quantity of the drugs. And that's pretty exciting. Instead of going to a neurologist and saying, I'm having off times, I need either stronger drugs or closer together. Definitely a better thing. These PCBs damage the ability of the cell to sequester dopamine, which I've mentioned can kill off the brain cells. So there's several good reasons to avoid polychlorinated biphenyls. In 1977, they switched to polybrominated diphenyl ethers. They also biomagnify in animal fat in the brain. They're now ubiquitous in the environment everywhere. And the damage to dopaminergic neurons is very, very similar. They also contribute to excitotoxic calcium signaling, excessive glutamate in the brain, which we find can be a problem with epilepsy and migraines, and perhaps not a good idea in general. So where are they found? Well, the top bar is fish oil. Isn't that a magnificent bar of pollutants in fish oil? Fish oil tends to biomagnify these pollutants very much. And the second bar is fish itself. Fish oil and fish are very commonly eaten, and they're very commonly polluted. As this is from the European Food Safety Authority, who did a nice worldwide study on fish. Polychlorinated diphenyl PCBs are everywhere. They're also found to a smaller extent in eggs and dairy products, and very sadly in baby foods. This is heartbreaking. Beef and vegetables. However, look at the bottom line right here. Fruits, vegetables, cereals, beans, nuts, almost none. They're not biomagnifying anything. They just grow and you eat them. And they're not so fatty, so they don't tend to accumulate the fat-loving lipophilic toxins as well. Now, one other thing about fish, there's another very common neurotoxin that's very well known, and that's mercury. And the route of biggest exposure to mercury is very well known to be fish. It's very easy to exceed your allowable mercury levels by eating fish. And mercury can be bound, interestingly enough, methylmercury, the form found in fish, can be bound to cysteine and transported by that same large neutral amino acid transporter into the brain where it can do its damage. It's been found to impact the normal functioning of the nigrostriatal dopamine system, which means the substantia nigra and the target part of the brain, the striatum, where the motor function is actually initiated. Increases oxidative stress, damaging the mitochondria. The mitochondria is a big part of Parkinson's disease. In familial Parkinson's disease, which makes up a very small fraction of people with it, you know, the inheritable part, the genes are defective, and what they found is the mitochondria gets damaged and dies. So might be a good idea to avoid mercury in fish as well. Okay, we finished that. You're all sitting here shocked going, wait a minute, I'm not eating red meat because I don't want a heart attack or a stroke. So then I've moved to chicken and fish, and now all of a sudden the fish are in big trouble. The chicken probably, chicken fat also accumulates these things. So it's time to move more toward a plant-based diet, or at least try it. It's really not that hard. You know, in our clinic, we hand out a sheet of substitutes for the various things, like the black bean burgers. Anyone here ever tried the black bean burgers? They're really excellent. And if you make a full-on hamburger with black bean burger instead of a beef burger, you're not getting these pollutants that are damaging the brain. You're getting a delicious hamburger with lettuce and tomatoes and pickles and mayo and all the good stuff you want on there. And many people will be satisfied with that, and you can lower your risk without suffering, you see. I know what you're all thinking. Oh, I'm going to really suffer at the dinner table. I can't have anything. As far as sausages goes, there's Tofurky makes some excellent sausages and a couple other companies that are, you can get the Polish sausage. And if you slice it up, fry it, throw it in spaghetti, you're going to have spaghetti and meatballs. And with the red sauce, it's going to be really quite delicious. There are all kinds of solutions. If you look these days, when I turned into a vegetarian at age 20 in 1970, none of these things existed. And it was really hard to find food. But nowadays, you can find lunch meat. A lot of people eat lunch meat for lunch. There are tofurkey slices that they sell in the store that are salty and tasty and chewy, but won't cause more Parkinson's disease. So if you look a little bit, you can find that you can have a delicious, enjoyable diet. I certainly enjoy my diet every day. Of course, I'm married to a gourmet chef. I think that helps a little bit. So now let's talk about some good foods. Okay, even if you didn't want to take anything out of your diet, you can at least can protect yourself with two things in soy products. Edamame or tofu or a lot of these hamburgers and hot dogs and things that are made from soy have genistein and diazine in them. And they've been able to found to restore tyrosine hydroxylase. Isn't that nice? Dopamine-producing cells that are not producing dopamine, at least from tyrosine, can now become restored and do that again. It might be nice if you also took some of the toxic load off from the milk and the fish. This is from a study, Frontiers in Aging Neuroscience, 2014. Restored levels of dopamine in the striatum after genistein was administered. do recommend organic soy because soy is sprayed with so many things these days that it, and organic soy is very widely available. I would recommend you go that route if you're going to include soy to help with your Parkinson's problems. Sesame is amazing. It has a dopamine-enhancing effect, again, increasing the biosynthesis of tyrosine hydroxylase. As I mentioned, this enzyme can be biosynthesized continually if there are polychlorinated biphenyls from fish damaging this enzyme, then it won't work. But it's continually remade. And sesame seeds, one of our favorite foods is sesame tahini, shown here, which is a Middle Eastern kind of topping. And we could pour it on vegetables or potatoes or use it as a salad dressing. And it really comes in handy as a quick, easy salad dressing. Meanwhile, it's helping you produce more dopamine. So here's something delicious to add to your diet, and I think if you try it, you might like it. We do. Flavonoids in general reduce risk and progression. Big study, went over 20 years, they found 25 to 40% less risk of developing Parkinson's disease, those consuming more flavonoids. Berries and apples, oranges, all fruits are good, even tea. They protect the dopamine neurons from oxidative damage and death. So this part of the talk, I'm talking about protecting your dopamine-producing cells. These are the guards that we're sending in, the soy guards, the sesame guards, the fruit guards, especially the berry guards. They're very good. Berries, the dark berries, if they're red or purple or black, they have proanthocyanidins that have been found across the blood-brain barrier and go in and protect our brain cells from both inflammation and oxidation, very common ways for brain cells to die off. Brain cells are very fragile. Their external layer of phospholipids has the most fragile, long-chain, very highly unsaturated fatty acids, you know, typically docosahexaenoic acid, DHA, and also arachidonic acid. And these are very susceptible to oxidation, so protecting them with berries is a good idea. So here's a prescription for a very delicious cup of berries every day, which in a nurse's health study was shown to delay dementia 2 years, make the brain 2 years younger. Just one cup of berries a day, something anyone here can do and enjoy. Green tea, black tea, they reduce the risk of Parkinson's disease 40 to 50%. Both the caffeine and the flavonoids work together to reduce the risk. So you might consider that this is a good thing. Now, here's a fun one. We know that people who smoke cigarettes are protected against Parkinson's disease risk. But instead of handing out packs of Camel cigarettes to everyone in the room, I'm going to suggest that you might consider eating more peppers, especially bell peppers. Now, it is very important that these bell peppers be organic because they're in the top 12 dirty dozen of foods that are sprayed right on the part that you eat. And the red ones are the older ones, so they're sprayed even more. But if you can get organic bell peppers, they found that they reduced the risk of Parkinson's disease 19%, but in people who never smoked, the risk was reduced to 87%. They may protect dopamine-producing neurons, and there may also be effect of a monoamine oxidase B inhibitor effect. In other words, keeping the dopamine around longer like a drug. But what a delicious drug. In my wife's cookbook, she's got a recipe called Best Friends. And you take cashews and chop them to the same small size as the red bell pepper. Just lightly saute them for a little while. And they make best friends with each other. The flavors merge together. And you have a delicious and colorful topping that you can sprinkle over pretty much anything. I like it on potatoes, and I really like it on vegetables. And it just transforms a dish into a more delicious dish. And while you're doing it, lowers your risk of any progression of Parkinson's disease. I'm going to talk a little bit about antioxidants. I know you've all heard the word. Parkinson's disease people have more tremors, more muscle contractions, and just like marathon runners, produce more free radicals. So it's essential for people with especially tremors and tight muscles to take in more antioxidants than the rest of people, the rest of us. And neuroinflammation could be part of the disease, can increase reactive oxygen. In fact, when they looked in the substantia nigra, in postmortem studies, they found that there was excess oxidation in people with Parkinson's disease, not only of fats, but also proteins, and even the DNA was oxidized. So we know for sure that people with Parkinson's disease have more oxidation in their brain, and oxidation can lead to brain death, not only of the dopamine-producing cells, but also of our thinking cells in the cortex and hippocampus. One of our best protections against oxidation in the brain and elsewhere is glutathione peroxidase. This enzyme protects us naturally against oxidation, but it doesn't work without selenium. And a lot of people don't get enough selenium. Now, those sesame tahini is rich in selenium, probably one of the reasons it works so well. I check my diet and other people's diets, and it varies how much selenium we get. Some days we get enough, some days we get too much, some days we don't get enough. So it's pretty hard to keep track of that. One way is you could every day eat one Brazil nut, which is high in selenium, and that would keep you going. You could include sesame tahini every day. That would work. You could take a really high-quality antioxidant vitamin, and that could possibly work. Or you can analyze your diet every day with my Diet Doctor software and see exactly what your selenium levels are. Very few people want to do that, not even me. Excess iron can increase oxidative stress, and this is a problem in the brain. Iron is a very unusual mineral. It's a necessary mineral for humans, but the plant-based iron is not absorbed right away. It gets stuck to the inside of the intestine, and if it's needed, our bodies will pull it in. If it's not needed, it goes away. But there's another form of iron called heme iron found in blood-containing foods like meat or chicken or fish, and this heme iron is absorbed whether or not we need it, increasing oxidation in the body. So another reason why that Brazilian study just restricting red meat was so effective in helping people with Parkinson's disease. Remember, 60% reduction in motor problems, walking, tremors, and so on. Here are the antioxidants. We have carotenoids colorfully in fruits and vegetables, vitamin C, fruits and vegetables, vitamin E, nuts, seeds, avocados, olives, polyphenols, berries, and many other plants. You'll notice that antioxidants are found only in plant foods and that animal foods do not contain antioxidants. Our own antioxidants, superoxide dismutase, requires zinc, copper, manganese, and for glutathione peroxidase requires selenium. And then coenzyme Q10 is made in the body. It's the only antioxidant enzyme that's fat-soluble that we humans make in our bodies. But if you're taking statin medication, that reduces our production of coenzyme Q10 about 40% for a typical amount. Is there anyone in the room not taking statin drugs today? Do we have a few hands going up? Oh, that's good. That's about half the people in the room. That's a little better than normal. So it might be a wise idea to take coenzyme Q10. In our successful Hawaii dementia prevention trial, coenzyme Q10 was one of the nutrients that we used to protect the brain against oxidation, and many people were taking statins in that trial, elders. In that trial, this brain and body food, we got special supplements for the trial that only trial members could take, but the people we're seeing in the clinic really wanted to take a similar formula, so we made this brain and body food for people with memory loss and dementia. However, the antioxidants are very similar to the ones that are protective of all brain cells. I look at different diets to see, do they have the antioxidants we need? The standard American diet, Atkins diet, had low in vitamin C, vitamin E, and carotenoids. The Zone diet, the Paleo diet, the South Beach diet got enough vitamin C, enough fruits and vegetables, but not enough vitamin E and not enough carotenoids. A really poor vegetarian diet, people eating omelets in the morning and maybe a cheese sandwich for lunch, macaroni and cheese for dinner, a lot of cheese and white flour and not much in the way of fruits and vegetables can rate just as poorly as any diet, not enough of any of the antioxidants. A Mediterranean diet did a little better, vitamin C, but didn't make it on the vitamin E. Those 13 milligrams are almost entirely from olive oil, of course, and not enough carotenoids. The two plant-based diets did really well, and got enough of all of the antioxidants necessary. The heart attack prevention diet, which is very low in fat, actually didn't score so well. Didn't get enough vitamin C, almost no vitamin E, the worst in the whole lineup. no fats, no vitamin E, and very low in carotenoids too. So just looking, standard diets, in other words, do you get enough of all of these antioxidants every day? If you're not on a plant-based diet, there's a good chance you may not be getting them, and you may not be getting enough to protect your brain properly. Vitamin E, delayed progression for 2.5 years in this study. Remember, vitamin C is essential to recharge vitamin E once it's been used to protect a brain cell. Vitamin E and beta carotene. Vitamin E reduced risk by 55% and beta carotene by 44%. And I think that it makes good sense that these would also be neuroprotective to reduce progression of the disease. In our clinical trial, by the way, we not only used the supplements for vitamin E, a very special form of vitamin E containing the gamma tocopherol form, we also recommended people eat walnuts every day and sunflower seeds every day, 1 ounce of each. This is part of our brain protective program. So we used both the highest quality supplements and food-based forms to just make sure these antioxidants were all covered. Certain vegetables reduced movement problems. Cruciferous vegetables, you know, broccoli, cauliflower, kale is now the big hero. These reduce movement problems. And treatment with sulforaphane, which is found in these, reduced motor deficits and protected dopaminergic neurons in a mouse model of Parkinson's disease. I mentioned berries before. They seem to keep dopamine-producing neurons alive. This is one of our goals, isn't it? We want to keep whatever, if we have 10% or 30% of our dopamine-producing cells left in our brain, we don't want them to die off. We need them. You cannot take dopamine. It has to be made in the brain. It can be made from levodopa or from tyrosine. So we need some of those cells active or the drugs won't work for us. Coenzyme Q10, I mentioned before, it both boosts energy production, which is a good idea, and it also is an antioxidant, working especially with the mitochondria, the fat-soluble areas of the mitochondria. Vitamin D slowed progression with Parkinson's disease. Slowing progression is just what we want. This study done in Frontiers in Aging Neuroscience in 2014, vitamin D supplementation stabilized patients' motor symptoms, preventing an increase in the Hoehn and Yahr scale, which would be an increase in symptoms, not only of motor, but perhaps also other areas, because vitamin D is also well known to help with neuroinflammation in the brain. Now, among the various plants used in the world, ashwagandha is a root used for a long time in Ayurvedic Indian medicine. Modern studies looking at it showed that it significantly increased dopamine production in certain brain cells and alleviated gait disorders. I mention it to you because it's safe and available and is something that can be tried. Let's say you don't want to change your diet at all. I want to give you lots of great ideas on things that you can add to protect yourself. Now, if you did everything, that would be even better in my book. But do what you can fit in, what you can work out. I know some people don't have full control over their food choices. You may live in a home where, you know, you have 3 choices for dinner and that's it. Sometimes those can be adapted. Sometimes they can't. Ginkgo biloba we did use in our Hawaii dementia prevention trial. You cannot take ginkgo biloba if you're on any blood thinners. So if you're on Coumadin, Warfarin, Pradaxa, Xarelto, Eliquis, any blood thinners, not a wise idea to take this because this also tends to thin the blood, but it's very protective to recover dopamine levels if you're not. It's very widely used to protect the brain throughout the world. It's a number one selling herbal supplement in Europe where it's used for brain power. Turmeric, we all know about turmeric. Curry's a great way to get turmeric, helps with neuroinflammation in the brain, and protects the dopaminergic cells, the dopamine-producing cells. Now, I've got a couple slides on Lewy body dementia. We would like our brains to stay sharp, as our bodies need to be sharp too. And we've found that a couple of things reduce the formation of alpha-synuclein in Lewy bodies. And turmeric, the curcuminoids in turmeric, prevent the aggregation of these abnormal proteins. Coenzyme Q10, I mentioned for several other reasons, also inhibits alpha-synuclein clumping. And beta-carotene, found in colorful fruits and vegetables, is also another excellent choice. There are a couple of plant components, bicalin and bicalene, that are found principally in skullcap, the Scutellaria species. And these have been found very effective for epilepsy, but I was amazed to see them once again, that they not only hinder alpha-synuclein aggregation, but they also have been shown to increase disaggregation of alpha-synuclein and Lewy bodies. So even better than not making more Lewy bodies would be to break up the ones that you have and return those brain cells to normal functioning. So I just wanted to mention those. Skullcap is quite sedating. So you wouldn't want to, for instance, drink skullcap tea before driving. The only time to take it would be in the evening, perhaps. It's very quieting to brain electrical activity, which is why it's so useful in epilepsy. And it does actually trigger the benzodiazepine receptors very much like Valium does, but not quite so powerfully. The effect that we're looking for would be the effect of inhibiting. So if you were going to take some kind of sleeping potion, you want to sleep easily through the night, you might consider skullcap instead of something that makes you dopey and sleepy, which it does not. And something addictive, which it is not, and something that would, during the night, perhaps break up a few of these Lewy bodies. Why not? So I want to get a couple summary slides for you. Eat plenty of berries, grapes, and other fruits. We can all do that, right? Not a problem. Increase your berries and fruits. If you put some washed, plucked off the stem red grapes in a cup next to you, that's all you need to do. Your hand will take care of the rest. They'll just disappear. It's really easy. Increase bell peppers, kale, and cabbage. These foods are very protective. They're also delicious. So fresh food's always good for you in so many other ways. Include sesame, tahini, and organic soy products for reasons that I mentioned. They're going to be protective for you. Stay away from animal fats and animal proteins. You don't have to be as strict as I am. I eat absolutely zero animal fats or animal protein. But within the realm of your comfort zone, and you might consider perhaps one day a week, substitute a meat substitute for a meat. You know, the fake sausage instead of the real sausage, or the fake burgers instead of the real burgers. Sedating skullcap along with stimulating green tea is one nice solution. I mentioned ginkgo, turmeric, and ashwagandha. All of this, by the way, is summarized in my book in case you couldn't take notes or remember absolutely everything. Coenzyme Q10, the RRR form of vitamin E only and not the synthetic alpha form at all. And vitamin D is absolutely a must for good health. I'm sure Bill Grant could tell us more about that one. Get enough copper, zinc, and manganese in some kind of supplement or in food every day. And that is my contact information. It's my personal cell number. I'd be happy to help any of you any way that I possibly can. Thank you for coming. Thank you.
Well, hello. Is this on? Okay, seeing no questions, I'm sure Steve and Catherine will be able to stand around afterwards and answer personal questions. So, at this point, I'd like to say that our thanks to Steve Blake for his comments here today. We also thank our audience. Oh, we have one question. Sorry. Coffee and red wine.
Two big favorites. I would probably get things thrown at me if I said anything bad about coffee or red wine. Coffee's actually been found to be protective. However, I would recommend, because coffee is a berry grown in the tropics by many small producers who use a multitude of pesticides sprayed right on the berries. When the berries are roasted, these pesticides can change into really alarming chemical compounds that, if you drink coffee, might I suggest organic coffee can be quite delicious, not that expensive. And as far as red wine, it is always better to eat grapes than to drink red wine. But if you're going to drink red wine, the typical maximum is just a glass per day for men and half a glass for women because of their smaller size. If you're a small man, maybe a little bit less. Again, they do make organic wines, and wines are, grapes are sprayed. So you might consider lowering your pesticide intake. Thank you for that question.
Okay. Another question about heavy metals like aluminum, mercury, lead, strontium. Do they cause Parkinson's, and what's the source of these in the diet?
Yes, and Alzheimer's. Heavy metals, well, aluminum is widely known to be a neurotoxin, and we used to think it couldn't be transported across the blood-brain barrier, which is very difficult to transport it. But one route of exposure is underarm deodorant sprays, which contain aluminum, can be absorbed nasally and through the sinuses into the brain. And it does seem that aluminum has been found in brains, especially Alzheimer's brains and Parkinson's disease brains. And the clumping that they make is not exactly the same as an Alzheimer's tau protein. It's very similar and just as damaging. So it's killing off the connections between the nerve cells and also killing the cells. I think avoiding aluminum is a good idea. It has no known use in the body, and good to stay away from it. So remember, the route of exposure is aerosol is perhaps the most scary. The other heavy metals, there's a lot more to go into with those. I think that might be beyond the scope of what I can answer, all those heavy metals.
Mm. What about plastic containers? What is leached from plastic containers that one has to be concerned about?
Plastic containers can leach out bisphenol A and phthalates, and those can be hormone disruptors in the body. I haven't seen direct evidence that they can cause Parkinson's disease. That evidence may be there, and I haven't found it yet. I'll keep looking. There certainly is. Now, another interesting thing is that these substances seem to leach only into fatty foods. So if you have a plastic wrap around your broccoli, it doesn't tend to leach into the broccoli. But if you have a plastic wrap around chicken, the fatty substance will leach the phthalates into that more. So that's kind of interesting, which foods are more toxic in contact with the plastics.
And do you know the mechanisms by which vitamin D reduces the risk of Parkinson's disease?
Bill, what are the mechanisms by which vitamin D reduces? We have the world expert on vitamin D here. I don't dare answer with him in the room.
Well, it does reduce inflammation, and
yes,
if inflammation is involved, that would probably be the main mechanism.
Good. I'm so relieved. I mentioned that in my talk today. Vitamin D is just crucial for all of us to get the required amount, and I think that in San Francisco, the upper limit set by the Food and Nutrition Board of 4,000 IUs of D3 per day is probably a very good idea. We can be assured that that's not too high a level. And I know San Francisco. I went to high school here, and it's hard to get enough vitamin D from the sun.
Right. If the brain has toxins, how can one remove toxins from the brain?
Well, of course, that depends on the toxins. Advanced glycation end products never leave. But the polychlorinated biphenyls do leave. And many, the dieldrin, the lindane, many of these persistent organic pollutants are continually cleansed from the body. The key is not to keep eating them. And as I mentioned, fish are the highest source, and other animal fats also bioaccumulate these things. If you stop eating them, they did some studies with children. It was fantastic. Their bodies cleaned up within a couple of weeks, and they're testing their blood and urine, and the levels of these pesticides went down, 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 just over a couple of weeks of not eating anything but organic vegetables.
Okay, I think given the time, I will call it here. Our thanks to Steve Blake for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating more than 113 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.